Welcome to the Investing Tutor Podcast, the show for professionals looking to master the most up-to-date strategies needed to build wealth and provide a stable financial future. Here's your host, Dr. Hans Boateng.
So joining us on today's podcast is the founder and CEO of Dream Exchange. He is Joe Sikela, the first Black-owned stock exchange. Joe Sikela is a former military officer, civil rights lawyer, securities lawyer, and CPA. He was part of the team that created the first company to trade securities over the internet. Friends, I believe we're going to have an incredible conversation today with regards to what Joe Sikela and his team are doing to bring us the first Black stock exchange. Joe, welcome.
Thank you so much. What a nice introduction. Thank you, sir.
So please, if you will, tell my audience a little bit about your vision for the Dream Exchange.
Oh, good. So our vision it's born from many, many years of helping small companies and small businesses. That's primarily what I've done in my career, and so has my staff. And the vision is to provide a mechanical way using a lot of financial technology to make people aware of the smallest businesses and to provide funds for small businesses that have great ideas. The simple way we say it is that we are here to help those who are dreaming of making the world a better place have their dreams come true. And that's really how we've made it as a society. It's how we've made it as a human race for hundreds, if not thousands of years, that the better ideas amongst the people of our society are those which we want to support. And today we need to create some mechanism, something that's in place to make sure that those ideas can receive the money they need to grow and expand, because those are the ideas for the future and those are the things that will help us to all live better lives. That's our purpose.
Have you noticed a shift in the funding of small businesses? And is that what drove you to want to create this exchange?
There's been a decades-long kind of change in the way small businesses are able to emerge. We've seen very, very small businesses, even in decades before this. You know, everyone knows the story that Apple Computer was created in a garage. So that shift has primarily been in favor of what I call relationship-driven investment opportunities. So if you know enough wealthy people, or you're connected to someone who knows wealthy people, then generally today you can find investors for a small business venture. And that is not what I consider to be a free and open market system. So if you don't know someone, but you happen to have a magnificent idea, something that's very valuable, it can be very difficult, if not impossible, to reach the investing public. So what we're trying to do is to accomplish getting the entrepreneur, the birthplace of great ideas, to be able to have increased access to a larger pool of people who will believe in their ideas, who are willing to support their ideas with investments, and to shift away from a purely relationship-driven investing, early-stage investing marketplace into a larger investment marketplace, so that the evaluation of those ideas can be done by a greater audience of investors, so that we can have support for things that will come into the marketplace and help us all to live better lives.
And the way that you're doing this is by creating the first, and I believe it's called a venture stock exchange. Can you share with us what a venture stock exchange is, as well as the Main Street Growth Act that is going to make this possible?
Sure. So today we are not a licensed stock exchange. So perhaps a bit of the question you're asking maybe requires a bit of an explanation of what stock exchanges are and what they do.
Yes.
Today there are only about 16 licensed stock exchanges in the United States. Those stock exchanges are largely concentrated on very, very large companies, and there's a lot of investing that's done that is through brokerage accounts, retirement accounts, you know, pools of money that are in the marketplace already, where they're doing the buying and the selling of very large company stocks. And that's good. There's no, we have no criticism for that at all. In fact, we intend to create one of those ourselves. But what we also noticed was that the marketplace for smaller companies, and this may sound like a lot of money to the audience, but $50 million and under initial offerings of stock to the marketplace at one time was the, I guess, the gold standard. You know, between 700 and 900 companies every year would seek money in the public marketplace, and 70 to 90% of those companies in any given year for many, many decades were $50 million and under. And today we have, you know, we have single digits. We have 4 or 5. Sometimes we have 10 companies that are that small that go to the general American investing public. So that problem, which we researched, it actually is in fact a problem. So one of the things we did very early was a work to design a way that the capital market system, that's what the stock exchange system is. It's the marketplace where people can display their company and their ideas to the general investing world and get support for it. Well, we looked at the capital market system and said, this is problematic for the small company. And the change that needed to happen really is legislative. It's a change in 87 years of laws in the United States pertaining to how a small company is able to seek investors. And so 5 years ago, my team, I have an outstanding team of government relations people. We began to work and communicate with members of the House of Representatives and the Senate. And there was already, this problem isn't new. It's not something we discovered. Everyone is aware that this exists. And there was already some formulation of a law that would allow for the creation of a new type of stock exchange called a venture exchange. And the concentration of these exchanges would be on companies that have much smaller amounts of money and have much lower volume in the daily activity of buying and selling, but they're really long-term companies. They're companies that you would invest in and hope to harvest wealth, because over time, the small company obviously grows into a larger one. So when we started to formulate the mechanics behind how a new law could be created, and we weighed in very heavily helping the members of Congress over the last 5 years create the Main Street Growth Act and the provisions that are in it that would allow for the creation of a brand new paradigm shifting marketplace. And that law has actually done very, very well. In 2018, 56 members of the House Financial Services Committee unanimously voted in favor of the law. That's very hard to do in today's environment. Obviously, there's a lot of political disconnect and acrimony between Republican and Democrat members of the Congress. And to get a unanimously consented to law was very difficult. However, in the law moved forward, and the entire Congress, 435 members of the House and 100 members of the Senate, voted in favor of this law at the end of 2018. And the only reason we're even talking today about the fact that it has not been enacted is because, if everyone remembers, the government was shut down at the end of 2018. And all of the laws that were passed during 2018 had to start the process over again in 2019. So the law is actually still pending because obviously we've had other things taking up our attention in the Congress between COVID and the impeachment and things like that. So it's still a bipartisan bill. There's Republican and Democrat co-sponsors. It's pending in both the House and the Senate. It'll either pass in the next 3 months or it will pass in the next Congress because the policy behind the law is well settled at this point, that the country does need the national investing public to be able to support these new businesses because the relationship-driven environment is one where if these small companies don't have exposure to a national marketplace, very often without establishing relationships with venture capitalists or private equity firms or angel investors, they aren't able to expand, and many of them fail. And they don't fail because they're a bad idea or a bad company or bad owners or the entrepreneur is not creative. They fail purely because they run out of the energy of finance. They run out of money to be able to continue to move forward. And that's a terrible thing. And the truth is that the greatest companies in our society today are ones that have really relied upon their ideas to move forward, and they weren't profitable. Tesla Motors is a great example. They're the world's largest manufacturer. They mass produce electronic cars, but they were not a profitable company until June of 2020. They'd never made net income, positive net income. So you can see that an idea whose time has come, which is the use of electronic vehicles in our society, is a wonderful idea. It's very valuable. And, you know, an entrepreneur who has a good idea, has something that he can actually really create, that just needs a marketplace where he can continue to get funds to create that idea and put it into existence, is of vital importance to us as a society. In essence, we're opening up, when we're open and when the law passes, it will open up an entire new marketplace that allows for smaller companies to have the value of their idea and the truth or falsity of their idea be judged in a democratic marketplace where the investing public can actually vote with their investment dollars for the best ideas.
You are helping to solve a major problem that a lot of people don't even realize exists. And it's the problem that when you have individuals with money, the angel investors, the accredited investors, right, the institutional investors, they are the individuals getting access to these venture companies. Yeah. And they are getting access to them at an early stage. So then wealth is being trapped within these networks of super rich and wealthy individuals who have access to the capital. And that is further causing a widening in the wealth gap, right? Because a retail investor like myself, I can't get access to, let's say, a company like Stripe or Robinhood, right? Which I even use as, you know, as my brokerage firm. But they're super rich and wealthy. I hear them talking about it all the time on their podcast. Oh, I'm an early investor in Robinhood. Well, you know, great for you. But like, I would want to own Robinhood as well, because it's obvious that it's an incredible company. So what you're saying, Joe, is that you are creating a platform that allows, you know, an everyday person to be able to get access to a company when it's a smaller company, right? Because for the person listening, let's say you had $1,000 and you placed it in a company that was 50 million, as Joe, you had described, and that 50 million grows to 500 million, right? That is 10x your money. If it grows to 5 billion, that's 100x. And if it grows from 5 billion to 50 billion, that means an individual would have had 1,000x return on their money. And precisely, for the person listening, to explain what that is, if a company was to go from 50 million to, let's say, $50 billion, if you had invested $1,000, that $1,000 would have grown to $1 million over that time frame, right? But then when we as retail investors come into the market and let's say we buy an Amazon or an Apple, Apple is already like $1.5 trillion. We're not going to get 100x return on our money, right? So what you're doing is so important and so valuable. And I just want to acknowledge you and thank you for that, because most people won't get it, but it can help close the wealth gap that's already, you know, hindering minorities and people of color.
Yes. And imagine this, to emphasize what you're saying. Imagine if the company's value was only $10 million when you invested.
Oh my gosh.
Right. So, and it's interesting because there are real world examples in the public marketplace that have, you know, this type of appreciation, and maybe it's over a 10-year period. You know, Netflix is a great example.
Yes.
Where people who invested and stayed with Netflix from its earliest time in the public markets have all been able to accomplish, you know, 1,000% return. But what's important about what you're saying is the word access. Access is a linchpin of everything we're trying to accomplish, because it's, you know, I often say there was a time period before the Facebook company went public that they were accepting investors. Some of the employees were selling their shares, and it was a marketplace. It existed for 2 years before Facebook was a public company. Now, I didn't have access to that opportunity. Most people didn't. So the question you would ask yourself is, you know, how were these people able to invest in Uber before Uber was Uber? How were they able to invest in Facebook before Facebook was Facebook? And the marketplace for those securities is non-existent today. There's not a marketplace. You actually have to, as you outlined, you have to have a relationship. And the truth is it works in two directions. It's wealth creation for the individual investor, so that if they're wise, and if they're choosing wisely, and if they develop an investment philosophy where they want to invest in early companies. We have companies that have wastewater technologies and electronic recycling technologies that are tremendous opportunities, and they're not public. But if that's your particular investment philosophy and you want to invest in one or more of those companies before they go to the New York Stock Exchange, there's already a tremendous wealth creation that exists for the early investor because they have access to the investment. But the other side of it that's of vital importance is this. It's the optimization of the value. In other words, the early stage company that's looking for its investors and finds a very good venture capitalist or a very wise private equity firm that has a lot of money. Well, there's an imbalance in the negotiation very often because they can determine the value and price and drive a very hard bargain so that the entrepreneur isn't able to really harvest the wealth of the company because the controlling part of the negotiation very often is in the hands of very few, very wealthy people. So when we open up the market, perhaps the earliest investors, they may pay more. They may pay a higher value to be part of Uber before Uber is Uber, okay? On the other hand, they'll be wealth building and wealth creating because in spite of the higher value they may get, when that company does eventually reach the national marketplace, the wealth will be shared among more participants. And the optimal price for the creator, because I'm sure there are creators in your audience. I love dreamers. The people, the audience we really are very interested in is the entrepreneur audience. These are the people who have the ingenious ideas. Where is the next Uber? We don't know them yet. I keep using Uber, but there's a menu of companies that exist, and they have very good ideas, and the opportunity for us to provide them with adequate capital to launch and move forward and hire staff and get their prototypes and customers and build their organizations really is reliant upon a private capital marketplace that when we create the venture exchange legislation and venture exchange businesses, the participants will build wealth, the entrepreneurs will have a more fair value for their company, and we can have a more patient, longer term view of the products and services that we create for our society. So there's a number of different ways that applies, in particular to the retail investor who is trying to build wealth. Maybe they have a 401k plan and they want to direct their investments as an individual into something that they believe is in their own wisdom going to be the future. We want them to have that access and freedom of choice in the capital markets.
And I see how this can also be beneficial for that Black founder or minority founder who is getting turned down by venture capitalists, right? Because, you know, most of them don't look like that venture company. So then a marketplace where, you know, individuals are coming to invest in companies, most of the racial biases that you see out in the market will not exist in like an exchange like Dream Exchange, which provides greater funding for these minority-owned businesses and eventually looks to level the playing field, if you will. So I can see that being an incredible benefit as well.
That's a specific market we are targeting. Many years ago, my firm, which was a merger acquisition firm, we were consulting the Chicago Urban League, and we were working with Black-owned businesses in Chicago. And it's not even that the venture capitalists, that there's a disparity in racial or ethnic lines. It's that the relationships don't even exist to find the company. This is a shift that will allow for, you know, a Black-owned company or a minority-owned company that doesn't even have the relationships. There are many, many private investors who are of goodwill. They're people of goodwill. They just don't even know where to go find the investment. Because after all, at the end of the day, the valuable company comes from the most obscure areas of our society. And if we don't have a way, a mechanism to, again, grant access, to introduce the, you know, obscure areas to sources of funds, then we can't even decide whether there is a color or an ethnic bias because they haven't even been introduced to one another. So what we're accomplishing is really twofold. One is we are targeting what we call the underserved marketplace. These are companies like the companies we were introduced to at the Urban League. Fantastic people. These were pedigreed people, by the way. Some of the owners of these companies were, you know, MBAs from Northwestern University and Harvard University. And they, in spite of their relationships, didn't have even a broad enough audience of investing relationships to keep their companies going.
And to your point, I believe you are right. Relationships do play a key role, right? If you don't know a Sequoia, right, you might not get the opportunity to walk through the door to be able to even pitch your idea because they are probably inundated with a ton of ideas. So unless they have like a founder like maybe Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey call in to put a word for you, it might be tough to get the visibility, to get the funding. So you are right about the importance of the relationships and how Dream Exchange can help, alleviate that. So Joe, next, I wanted to touch on or talk about wealth creation. Most of So for me, growing up, I didn't really even understand how the stock market worked, you know, how wealth is built with entrepreneurship. You know, based on your knowledge and experience, can you walk us through how wealth is created, especially in the U.S.?
Believe it or not, most wealth creation in the United States exists from ownership or owning equity in a business. So small businesses, very often the families of the small business owner, they tend to be wealthier because they own the business and they're able to not only earn a living, but they own something, an entire enterprise that they've created value in. Now, we have an entire generation of people, the baby boom generation, who are becoming older. They own small businesses and they're transitioning from that, you know, generational ownership into another generation of ownership. And they're really looking to harvest their wealth either by selling the business or expanding it. It's the same thing that an entrepreneur would do today by working. And, you know, there's an old joke, after 30 years of hard work, I've become an overnight success. So the fact is that the American wealth building in our country has, by and large, been born in two different ways. One is by creating and building a company that one owns and then either resells at the end of a career, or by investing in those types of companies, even if they were small public companies.
One of the fascinating topics that I've heard you discuss is this concept of the value of an idea and your belief in how economics, like in the future, is going to shift. Can you take a moment to speak to us about, you know, the value of an idea and your belief in the shift when it comes to economics?
This is the most dear to my heart part of what we're doing. And it is a philosophy that our company has. And our philosophy is that the value of any product or service and its long-term value to all of us is directly related to the degree that that value enhances our ability to survive and to thrive as human beings. And this is something that we've researched. It's not something that is merely a statement by which we're saying, just believe us. The proof of this concept is or surrounds us. 120 years ago, if you wanted to go to the market, you had to leave your front door and get in a horse-driven carriage to go to market. Today, we go to grocery stores that are filled with products in a climate-controlled vehicle. And where did all of those enhancements to our ability to survive come from? Well, they were merely ideas. They were all, in their infancy, a human being with a creative idea. And we've changed the way human beings live on Earth in the last 120 years. And that creation has all shown that ideas that can perpetuate our ability to survive better are in fact worth more money. That someone who has a cure for cancer has a more valuable concept or idea than someone who has an idea to make a plush beanbag toy. We're not against plush beanbag toys, but the value of the idea itself and the investor's philosophy behind investing in it really is born from how frequently will the entire human race use that idea once it's an actual product, and what is its properties towards helping us to be better as a species? You know, Facebook, for example, is a great example of this. It's merely a communication system. But in its communications, what it has provided is an intimacy. It's somewhat controversial today, but the intimacy with which we reach communications on Facebook is profound. It's a more intimate communication device than has ever been created. Well, the value of human intimate communication is priceless. It's what we do with our families. It's what we do with our friends. It's not merely a telephone call from a marketing company. It's that intimacy in the groups and in the communication flowing on Facebook that makes them very valuable, and it makes us better as a species. Now here, the frequency of its use, I think I once saw a survey that said the average Facebook user goes onto Facebook about 12 times per day. And the population of Facebook is in the hundreds of millions of participants. So if you have a product that will touch the lives of hundreds of millions of people 12 times a day to expand the intimacy of communication, you have an enormously valuable product. Now, not every product is going to accomplish that order of magnitude, but even the smallest of companies in the most obscure parts of our society have ideas that will touch millions of people, and you can do that rapidly. And if your idea, in fact, helps us to be better off, people will pay more money for it. And if I could take another minute, I can actually tell you one of the ways this was born, this mathematical calculation that we use to score the idea, the value of the idea, is based upon certain principles of physics. So it's not something that we are just speculating upon. And there's a professor at the University of Wisconsin who's the director of research for the Dream Exchange, and he and I have collaborated now for nearly 10 years. And the interesting example that dawned on us long ago has to do with organic eggs. My wife was buying organic eggs at the grocery store. This goes back 10 years. And I noticed that the price of a dozen organic eggs was more than two times the price of the ordinary non-organic eggs. And rather foolishly, I asked her, well, why would you buy those eggs? They're twice as much money. And in almost a stern way, she said to me, they're better for us. They're better for our family. This is what I want to feed our children. And in that moment, it occurred for me, is she right? Like, is there any research that says eating an organic egg is any better? And I thought, it really doesn't matter. What matters is, do we believe we're better off doing an activity or buying a product? So I began this process of surveying for 10 years at the grocery store. Ma'am, you're buying organic eggs. May I ask you why? And for 10 years, I've gotten universally a response. Well, they're better for my family. They're going to help me to survive better. So if you look at this, what's called a microeconomic example, and I'm giving a trite example because we've done extensive research on this in other areas, but universally, people will pay 2.5 times the value for an egg merely because they believe that it helps them to survive better. And I've recently even taken photographs because I go to the grocery store and the organic eggs are sold out and the other eggs are filled. The shelves are filled with the other eggs. They sell out first. And the truth is that the value of the idea behind a survival product, organic food, is worth 2.5 times the ordinary food. Now, perhaps the affording, there are other factors that may go into it. If you want to have eggs and you can't afford to pay the premium price, I mean, that's okay. The other product exists. On the other hand, you can see that all consumer choices involve evaluating the product that they will choose, believing it that they will be better off. And what we're trying to accomplish is allowing for the free marketplace of ideas to exist in a capital market so that we can even know that products like the organic eggs exist. That's the main goal of what we're trying to do, which is well beyond generationally merely creating a stock exchange.
Can people apply this concept of the value of an idea to perhaps current public companies? Do you think that that is something that the average person can do? So, for example, looking at this idea through the lens of like maybe looking at like a Tesla or some or a company like that.
It's absolutely something that for the large companies is in fact somewhat easier to evaluate on your own. Excuse me, I'm sorry. It's easier to evaluate in your home, for example, if you want to look at the product offerings of the largest companies. It's an easier evaluation because you know the entire menu of products, and you also know the strategic plan that the company has for its future. So you can evaluate the long-term capabilities of what those companies will be doing and what their impact on the entire planet will be.
Ajua Sikela, thank you so much for, first and foremost, your time and for embarking on such an important project, which I believe, and I'm sure all of my listeners believe, will make a great impact. Now, for individuals who are interested in wanting to know more about the Dream Exchange or when it's going to be launched or some kind of timeline as to what to expect, if you will, take the next minute or two to just share with my audience so that they know, they're able to have an idea of what to expect.
Sure. How to participate. So we are today launching, and it's launched for probably about, I want to say the last month and a half. We have a product called DreamX Connect, and that's available today. So if you go to our website and you want to link to DreamX Connect, entrepreneurs can download all of the information on their company. And it's a social media platform for entrepreneurs where you can put your company's information and investors can also put their information, and you have a private messaging board. You can communicate with one another. It's a free service. So it's just like Facebook or LinkedIn. You can go there and get access to one another. And if there's a private investor that you want to engage with, you can use the email and messaging board in DreamX Connect today. That's not a stock exchange. There's no mechanics behind our products behind that other than social media to allow people today to begin meeting each other in an environment that kind of shares our philosophy. We have over 400 companies in there in the last month and a half. We probably have as many, we're approaching 500 investors who will be able to search for each other in a social media environment. So that's happening today. And there are other small educational product offerings we have. Some of them, there's nominal fees that you can pay to become educated if you're an investor or entrepreneur. And then the timetable for the exchange. So the exchange is under construction. We have our programming teams working, and it's a bit of an undertaking to make sure we create what we refer to as the pipes. So we're building the electronic mechanisms that will become the exchange. There's two different licenses we'll be applying for during the next 12 months. We're hoping to launch by the end of next year. It's a bit of a tight timetable, but we're diligent in working on it. We have a whole team of programmers that report into me every day. So we're about a year away from our launch. But also you have a way by going to our website of keeping up to date on our progress and being able to stay in communication. We have senior staff that are available to answer any of your questions. So if you go to dreamx.com, it's dreamex.com, you can get all the information you need about Dream Exchange, and you can monitor our milestones towards opening this stock exchange during the next year.
Joe, this is the last question I ask every guest. So we know about generational wealth, where you pass on wealth to the next generation and to the next. I thought of this concept of generational wisdom, right? So if you were leaving, let's say, a blank piece of paper and you were putting on there just three core things that you want the next generation to know because it can impact them significantly, whether it's with life, wealth, or relationships? You know, what three core pieces of advice would you share as your generational wisdom nuggets?
Thank you for that question. The first piece of wisdom is, after 30 years of participating in finance, the first piece of wisdom I would pass along is, don't always believe the one-line headline statements like greed is good or it's a dog-eat-dog world. Those are not, they're not true. Kindness and compassion and treating other people fairly has made more people in my personal environment wealthy and successful than any other policy. You have to have good partners, you have to have good employees, and all too often when people enter into the financial world, they take on a different personality, and that personality leaves the humanity of what they're doing in their life behind in favor of something that is a bit more callous. So the first thing I would say is that using kindness and compassion in your daily affairs is far more valuable than money. The second thing of most importance to me personally is this, the economic philosophy we're putting forth. And that is that the imagination, your imagination, and the ideas you create are valuable. Never let anyone tell you that your idea is worthless, because those are usually the people who have the most difficulty. They are the pioneers. They are the people who tend to change the world with their imagination. I believe that the imagination is the place where wealth and money and prosperity are born. So that's the second thing, is use your imagination every day. Outcreate the barriers to your success so that you can see a better world, the one in which you want to live. And the last one is very personal to me. I have six children. I'm a little older. I'm not an old man yet, but I do believe that the future is better than the past. And it only comes about if we all can participate with one another and really live by principles that are unconditionally loving toward our fellow human beings. So never do anything in your business or your personal life that you would not want done to yourself. In doing that, you have to first and foremost love yourself, and your ideas and your investment ideas and your company's ideas and your way of living your life are valuable, and never be discouraged by the fact that on some days, and I've experienced this personally, those ideas may only be valuable or seemingly be valuable to you. But if it's valuable to you, use your self-determinism and use the future you have and the time you have on this earth to make it a better place by caring for and loving your fellow human beings. So those are my three top things. I do those every day.
Well, Joe Sekela, thank you so much. I wanted to acknowledge you. I know you're a very busy individual. You know, you've had interviews with Fox, Wall Street Journal, Black Enterprise, but you took the time to speak with us today. So I just want to acknowledge you for that, to thank you sincerely for taking the time. And I want you to know that, myself included, with the audience, we will be celebrating when the Dream Exchange launches. So once again, thank you for this opportunity to have this conversation with you.
Thank you too, and I look forward to the celebration.